Benjamin Matt here, coming to you from all the way in Bethlehem Township. Of course, we're home. We're in quarantine. Hope everybody out there is safe and sound. Practicing good social distancing. But here we are, me and Posman Josh, coming to you live.
Hello.
Hello, Josh.
Nice to hear your voice.
Yeah. So, we actually had quite a few questions raised in our most recent podcast. And what we wanted to do today was we wanted to go over at least three of the questions and maybe discuss them a little bit.
People love Gabby Kravitz. That's one thing we've determined.
Yeah, people love Gabby Kravitz. They like cravings.
They can't get enough. Yeah. They can't get enough of him. He's a hit.
So, I guess without further ado...
let's open up that mailbag.
Just open up that mailbag.
Here we go. Let's do it.
Yeah, we have some friends out in Colorado. Hello, Colorado folk. Thank you for some of these questions. Let's see. Number one, really great question relating to Gabby Kravitz. Was Pete Rose the last player manager? Josh, can you tell me about that?
Well, first of all, the answer is yes. Pete Rose was the last player manager. I've been enjoying going through the lists of player managers, and I know you were looking at it too. There were, so Rose was the last, what year was he doing it? In the early 80s?
Like 87, maybe. Oh, late 80s.
Okay.
Right around when he would, you know, obviously, those of you know, he got caught betting on baseball and was banned. But at the time, he was a player manager, or at the very least, he may have been a manager. But there was a period where he was a player as well. And do you have the exact date on that, Josh?
I do not.
86.
All right,
yeah,
thank you. 86
was the last year.
Good. I was enjoying looking at the list of going back to our era here of the, you know, 1920s or early before even. It was incredibly common. It seems like every other team had a player manager. And there were some really huge Hall of Fame names on there. Just about every great player from the era spent some time managing. Who were some of those names, Matt?
Well, right off the bat, some pitchers. Christy Mathewson, Three Finger Brown. And then, of course, some, like, in my opinion, the greatest shortstop to ever play, Honus Wagner. And then we had Ty Cobb, Trish Speaker, and others.
Hornsby?
Hornsby.
There you go. Yeah.
Eddie Collins, George Sisler. All sorts of guys.
You can make a Hall of Fame starting nine with player managers, probably. And it did last longer than you might think. There's a couple names I was surprised to see on there in the more modern era. Any more modern names jump out at you and surprise you there, Matt?
Well, there was Joe Torre. I had no idea. And Frank Robinson, I think, were the two big ones that we found.
I remember reading about Frank Robinson because, you know, African-American managers are really rare for a long, long time, and they still are. But Frank Robinson, wasn't he the one who broke down, who was the first one?
I believe he was the first black manager in Major League history.
Yeah, so yep. I remember reading about Robinson, but I had no idea Torre was still a player at the time that he started his managerial career. So that was pretty interesting. I do not think we'll see it again, player manager. I'd be shocked if we did.
Why do you think that, Josh?
I mean, I just think that the game has gotten so complicated. I think that, you know, when you were a manager in 1920, there was a lot of, like, set-it-and-forget-it style of managing. You had your pitcher, your starter, he was going to go pretty much the whole game. You didn't shift. You didn't have a lot of offensive strategy. I mean, you might have done a hit-and-run here and there, but that was your third base coach anyway. And now it's like the manager's got, he's got to keep track of ever see those little cards that Joe Maddon keeps in his pocket? I mean, he's got 1,000 things to keep track of between matchups, defensive shifts, bullpen usage, you know, splits on this or that for each player on his team and on the other team. I just think back then it was like, go get them, boys. I mean, there was, you know what I mean? Like, it was a lot simpler. So
what you're suggesting basically is that the distractions of the modern game would potentially take away from their ability to concentrate on just being a good player.
Yeah, I don't think you could possibly do
and
both.
Vice versa.
I don't think you could possibly do both. If you're like up there trying to face a 98 mile an hour slider and you're also trying to think like, who am I warming up for the next inning? in like, and where am I positioning my left fielder? Like, I mean, there's just, there's, the game's gotten way too complicated. So there's, it's so specialized that I don't think you could, I don't think you could do it.
That's a really excellent point, because that's not something I had actually thought about when we talked about this. And I think it's a better point than what I was thinking, because I was thinking that it may never happen again for a different reason, and that reason being this kind of element of control that these teams want to have over their organization.
Mm.
And how, you know, there's like a hierarchy and a structure in place, you know, between the owner, between the general manager and president, and the manager. And we see that a lot today in terms of, you know, the sabermetrics and the decisions that are being made. Sometimes we don't know for sure, but, you know, the decisions that are being made day to day, game to game, may actually come from above the manager. So that was like another, that was another theory that I had about that one. But I actually kind of like your theory better.
I'm sure that's part of it too, you know? I remember hearing a lot, obviously with the Phillies, like they wondered how much Kapler was getting in-game decisions from the front office. And
yeah.
Right. Just not that it's a big deal, but I like to imagine what would happen when the manager's on base and the third base, like who tells him to steal? Like say you're Ty Cobb and you're on first, and like, is your third base coach giving you a sign? Or say you're Ty Cobb and you're up to bat and your third base coach tells you to bunt and you don't want to. I mean, if you're Cobb, you probably don't do it anyway, but that, I just think that must be funny. Like if you're the manager and you're on base or you're at bat and you're base coach, I wonder if there were ever disagreements about who to, what you should be doing when you're up there. It's just funny to imagine.
In our back pocket, in another future episode, I think we should maybe look into
famous
disagreements in baseball history between manager and player.
Good.
Or between two managers, you know, coach and manager.
Yeah, specifically the player manager would be a very odd.
Yeah.
If you're a pitcher, yeah. And you have to decide when to take yourself out of the game? That's weird, too. Like, if you're the pitcher and the manager. So, anyway, very interesting phenomenon of early baseball, the player-manager. Sadly, we probably won't see it again. But that was an excellent question. And let's go
probably
back to...
Won't, but, yeah, I'd love to see it as well. It'd be a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Just like, you know, like, what's his name is so much fun now. The Angels player. The hitter and pitcher. Can't think of his name.
Oh, right, Ohtani.
But yeah, you know.
Yeah, make him a
dimensional, but it's fascinating.
They should make him the manager too. Make him a pitcher, fielder, and manager. Why not?
Yeah, I mean, you know, of course, you know, you remember, and I'm sure, you know, we were a similar age. You know, Deion Sanders, Bo Jackson, I think Brian Jordan. You know, the players from when we were younger that just captivated me. The two sport players, similar kind of thing.
Yeah,
player manager doing two roles, you know, a person capable of doing, you know, two very, very unique kind of jobs at once. So
yeah.
Anyway,
cool.
Great question.
Cool stuff. Thank you.
All right. So next one. Do you want to explain? Okay. So we had a question in a previous episode. We mentioned, I think it was the Gabby Carrebath episode, that we talked about the Chalmers Award. Can you talk to us about that, John?
Yeah, so in my little side note on the Gabby Carrebath piece, we were talking about when Gabby was a finalist for the MVP award. I forget what year that was. But he did... He came in second, but the vote was at the time was actually called the Chalmers Award. So I just sort of mentioned that in passing. And one of our listeners wanted to know, what is the Chalmers Award? Who's Chalmers? What's that about? And it is actually a fascinating story, like so much stuff in history or in old baseball. When you lift one rock, you know, you find something else. And so in the early days of baseball, 1910, Hugh Chalmers was an auto dealership owner in Detroit. And so Hugh Chalmers just wanted to promote his car dealership, and he started running ads saying he would give a new car to whoever had the highest batting average in the American League. The Detroit being a American League town. And who do you think was top in the running for the batting crown that year? 1910 Detroit.
Was it was Ty Cobb?
That's the one, Ty Cobb, right? So Ty Cobb was in line to win the Chalmers Award, to win the car, because it was given just for the highest batting average. It wasn't given, it wasn't voted on. It was just a straight up numerical thing. And comes down to the last day of the year, and a player by the name of Nap LaJoy, who played for Cleveland, was a few percentage points behind Cobb in the running for the batting crown and thus the new car. And Cobb was not well liked at the time or since, but we'll get into that later. But LaJoy, I forget who the Indians were playing, but they decided they didn't want Cobb to win. So they let LaJoy get five straight hits. They just played really deep on the infield, and they just let him bunt for a base hit over and over again to raise his average above Cobb's. So that became that was like a whole scandal in 1910. It didn't. The season was already over. It was the last game of the year. I mean, the season in terms of the standings. But these guys decided to let the likable LaJoy win the Chalmers Award, win the batting crown, win the car, instead of Cobb, who they did not like.
All right, let me just correct you on that one, Josh. I think Ty Cobb actually technically ended up winning the award, even though there was a big controversy. The controversy, I think, as you mentioned, the Browns manager basically ordered the third baseman, Red Corden, to play on the outfield grass, letting LaJoy bunt for every at-bat. He went 8-for-8.
Oh, it was a doubleheader. Yeah.
Yeah, but actually the last one was ruled an error. So he didn't end up technically with the same batting average.
I did not know that. I always thought it worked. I always thought that Cobb lost the crown.
After everything was said and done, they both got a car. After Ben Johnson stepped in. But like you alluded to, I think this led to the Chalmers Award kind of quickly becoming faux pas. And I think you were going to talk about that at some point.
Soon after, I guess, it became more like what we know as the modern MVP award, where it was voted on instead of just that statistical, figuring. So, yeah, soon after that 1910 scandal, that's amazing that they let him go 8-for-8 to try to get the car instead of Cobb. The error got him. That's amazing. I somehow missed that detail in the story. That's great. And so Hugh Chalmers really just a local car dealer, and must have been an early car dealer too, because like 1910, like car dealers.
So it says Chalmers ceased to exist in 1923. However, it is a direct predecessor to modern day Chrysler.
Oh wow! So he really, way to go, Chalmers. He was really like a car leader and a pioneer in baseball sponsoring things. And also, got his name associated with the early MVP award for all time. So now, and soon after that, it became voted on. And so Hugh Chalmers, Detroit auto magnate, and gave his name to the award. So that's a good question. That's great that led us down another little interesting tale to a story of 1910. And I think in a future episode, we're going to have to pick up the debate as to whether or not Ty Cobb deserves the villainous reputation he's been given. I just the other day happened to see something where the biography that is most responsible for the worst parts of Cobb's reputation had a lot of falsehoods, which is not to say he was a saint, but that maybe Cobb is not quite deserving of the villainous reputation he was given. So that's for another time. We'll look into that another time.
Yeah, I think that might be worthy of an episode, definitely. I think it's a great idea. All right. So I have one last question for Podsman Josh.
All right, let's hear it.
Again, this relates to, I believe this relates to Gabby Cravath. What is a Superba? That's Superba.
Right, so I mentioned that the Brooklyn Dodgers were called the Brooklyn Superbas in that era. And it is a very weird word, first of all. It's like the word super, S-U-P-E-R, and then B-A. And it's not a word that makes any sense or means anything to modern times. But what it relates to is the particular guy, Ned Hanlon, who was the I think it was the owner of the Brooklyn Club. And so, or was he the manager? I think he was the manager. So Ned Hanlon was the manager of the Brooklyn Club, and he there's a whole long story, like there always is. He actually combined two teams. He took the team from Baltimore and the team from Brooklyn, and he combined them. And it wasn't like the Super Bowl. It wasn't like because they were super. It was just because there was this vaudeville team, because the vaudeville act called Hanlon Super Boss. Totally unrelated to Ned Hanlon, but they were like acrobats. They were called Hanlon Super Boss. They were just like a famous performing, like what, Flying Valenzas or like whatever, some like just family or whatever, troop, Hanlon Super Boss. And so because Ned Hanlon managed the team, they called him Hanlon Super Boss. And that was in that era where team names seemed so much more fluid than they are in our minds currently. Like the city was the main thing. Like you were the Brooklyn Club. You were the Brooklyn, or you were the New York American League Club. Or and then the team name itself, they always changed them. They gave, like, the half the articles you see about the Yankees in this era where they called them the Hugmen because Miller Huggins was their manager. They always just, or they would call the Cleveland team the Naps because LaJoy was their player manager and their star. So the official name and the name on the jersey and the you know, the what it showed in the standings in the newspapers and whatever was the city name, and the team name itself was really kind of fluid. I don't know how you officially like when they officially decided they were the Super Bas and then the Dodgers. They were also called the Bridegrooms for a period of time. The Brooklyn squad was the Brooklyn Bridegrooms. So team names,
and the trolley Dodgers was the original Dodgers, right?
Yeah.
Am I wrong in that? Yeah.
Well, I don't know. I mean, that's where the name came from. I know that. Yeah. But I don't know if they were, I don't know if we ever.
So it sounds, yeah. It sounds like there was like a real fluidity in terms of, you know, maybe you and I would have two different names for our beloved, you know, instead of one person would call them the Fightin' Phils, one would call them the Liberty Bells or something.
Or the Girardis. I was trying to think what.
The Girardis.
I was trying to think what, yeah. what current major league team would have a good. I was thinking like Dusty Baker. That you could call a team the Bakers. That's pretty good.
But, the Houston Verlanders. yeah, I don't know. And I think like what you touched on exactly, is all pretty much just based around the city. And uniform. I think we established uniform numbers didn't even come until the Yankees started that tradition later, right?
Right.
Yeah, and I was surprised, you know, just recently when the Senators were revived. Or the Washington Nationals were revived, that they didn't choose the name Senator, because, you know, growing up, when I learned my baseball history and my Walter Johnson history, it was always, you know, Washington Senators. But as it turns out, the official name of the Washington Baseball Club was the Nationals, and that's probably why they chose Nationals. So, you know, it just goes to show maybe what we recognize as the official name versus the nickname may be very different. So
the Senators wasn't even the team name officially?
No.
I didn't know that.
No, I mean, it was a nickname that was used, and Nats was also used, but the official name, according to this article, 1905, it was the Washington Nationals.
That's interesting. Yeah, I know when we looked at the contract that Ruth signed, it didn't mention the words Red Sox or Yankees. It just said Boston Club and New York Club. So it was more nicknames. Super Boss, just because of the weird coincidence that their manager had the same name as a vaudeville star, we got ourselves the Hanlon's Super Boss as a nickname for the Brooklyn team. So it didn't last long. And before long, they, you know, all these teams settled into their longer term names somewhere around this time. But definitely early 20th century, we had a lot of fluidity in our team names. The Phillies were the Blue Jays for 1 year. I know that.
That's right. And wasn't there a uniform that was based around that or something recently?
Good question. We'll look it up.
Okay.
And we will look up all sorts of stuff on BAPL.org. I got to do commercials for the library. And then we can look up all the upcoming news. I'm getting excited for opening day. I mean, 1920's opening day.
Yeah, we don't have a baseball season here in 2020, but thank goodness we have one in 1920.
We didn't know we'd be filling this massive national need for baseball content when we started this. And here we are doing the work that our time requires of us, Matt.
Exactly.
Sitting here on the floor in my living room in sweatpants with a talking into an iPad, doing the work that the Lord has chosen for me. Excuse me. So, yes, we will do some more research. It really is pretty soon. April is, tomorrow? And then April 20th, I think. Is that right? Opening day was a little later back then. So we got a little bit of time. We're going to give you preseason hot takes, hot kettle takes. We're going to give you some more player profiles and some debates about all to come in the 1920 baseball season.
All right. Thanks for joining.
Thank you, Matt. Stay safe over there.
All right, Posman Josh, you as well.
All right. I will talk to you soon. Till next time.
All right.
Bye-bye.
All right.